Arthur and Jackie Seal moved to Hilton Head, South Carolina, where they purchased a furniture store, bought a marshfront house in an exclusive neighborhood, enrolled their children in private schools, and seemed to have reestablished themselves. After a little more than a year, however, they hastily moved away from South Carolina, evading $715,000 in debts and court claims. Before long, they had returned to New Jersey to live with Arthur's parents. According to court records, in December 1991, Arthur and Jackie had started to covertly survey Sidney Riso's cul-de-sac and to plot a kidnapping scheme. The couple constructed a wooden box 6 feet 4 inches in length and 3 feet 6 inches in width and placed it in a rented storage locker. Arthur consulted bankers in the Bahamas about how he might avoid taxes if he came into a large pile of cash. On that Thursday spring morning at the base of his driveway, when Sidney Riso stopped as usual to pick up his newspaper, Arthur Seal grabbed him by the collar, wrestled him toward a white van, and in the scuffle, accidentally fired a .45 caliber pistol, wounding Riso in the forearm. Seal said later that his wife treated the wound with hydrogen peroxide, and that the victim called him Sir as he bound and gagged him with duct tape and placed him in the prefabricated wooden box. In Seal's estimation, the container was much larger than a coffin, more like a closet. On the afternoon of May 2nd, the kidnapper and his wife inspected their container and discovered that Riso had died. They hauled his body to a state forest in southern New Jersey and buried him. Afterward, they continued to demand ransom from Exxon until the FBI arrested them. The Exxon Valdez accident had been preventable. It exposed the risks that arise when industrial systems of enormous scale and consequence are entrusted to imperfect human beings without adequate safeguards. Sidney Riso's death 3 years later was of a different character and perhaps not preventable at all. Like the spill in Prince William Sound, however, it shocked Exxon's corporate culture. Lawrence Rawl was crushed by the loss of his colleague. The kidnapping reinforced a broader sense within the corporation, reeling from criticism and lawsuits over the Valdez, that it was under siege. It reinforced, too, a sense that Exxon's leaders might need to find new ways to exert greater control over the world in which they operated, to seek a rebalancing, in Lee Raymond's phrase, of the management of risk. The changes that Raymond would soon impose on Exxon would alter the experience of every employee and manager who worked at the corporation in the years to come. During the early 1990s, Exxon increasingly became Lee Raymond's company. Lawrence Rawl retired as chairman in 1993 at age 65, but the practical transfer of power had begun earlier. After the Exxon Valdez grounding, at the corporation's monthly board meetings, it was Raymond who reported to the board about the results of his investigations into the accident's causes and about his assessment of what corporate policies should be changed in response. His updates and recommendations for reform, linked to the Valdez investigations, were part of every board meeting for probably 2.5 years, he recalled. The Valdez wreck and soft global oil prices, which argued for cost-cutting beyond the steep reductions of the 1980s, offered an opportunity to push through sweeping management reforms within Exxon at a pace that would have been difficult to achieve without the rationale of crisis. Even before the accident, Rawl had been trying to shake up Exxon's bureaucratic ways. The 1980s had been a painful decade for oil corporations. 2 Arab embargoes during the previous decade, designed to punish the United States for its support of Israel, followed by the 1979 Iranian Revolution, had driven crude prices to undreamed-of highs. But by late 1985, prices had collapsed steeply. The unexpected drop squeezed cash flow so badly that for a short period, Exxon borrowed money to pay its shareholder dividend. According to Raymond, Rawl, the former Marine sergeant, believed that Exxon was top-heavy and didn't have the accountability it needed. We had committees on committees. Advancing his mentor's drive to tear up the old Exxon organization charts and march forward in double time, Raymond drove home an operating philosophy in which managers would be measured more directly for their performances, and safety systems would be driven relentlessly toward zero defects. Raymond set up a program for every Exxon division and affiliate worldwide to reappraise risk. Many large industrial corporations sought to emphasize worker safety, but after the Valdez and Riso episodes, Exxon's system became deeper and more pervasive than that of any of its peers. To encourage internal whistleblowing about safety, fraud, or discipline problems, Raymond established a hotline or anonymous post office box where employees could report violations. He oversaw changes in Exxon's drug and alcohol policy. He scrutinized every job category and named about 13% of them as designated safety positions that would henceforth be subject to special rules. These positions included not only oil tanker captains, but also gasoline delivery truck drivers and equipment operators in refineries and chemical plants. In the future, if an employee voluntarily entered drug or alcohol rehabilitation, he or she would not lose employment at Exxon, but would be prohibited from ever working again in one of the designated safety jobs. A new drug and alcohol testing program took hold, affecting both those who had sought treatment and all of those who worked in the designated safety jobs, irrespective of their personal histories. Raymond decided that the latter category should include the corporation's top 300 executives, even if all they did was push paper. This edict became known as the Raymond Rule. The rules seemed more likely to drive alcoholism among senior executives into the shadows than to ensure sobriety at the top. But the emphasis now was on universal mechanical systems.